got to. So let me do schedule first, and then we'll pick up. We're going to be at chapter 17, if you're wanting to 17? Get to, because we finished 16 last week. So we're going to be at chapter 17 when we get going. We will meet next week, which is the 29th of January. The 5th of February is the annual school district strategic planning retreat that I'm a part of. So there will not be Bible study the 5th of February. We will meet the 12th of February. The 19th of February, I'm going to be on retreat. So there will be no Bible study that day.
19th, you said.
Yeah. Okay. And then the 26th is Ash Wednesday, and because because there's church and people coming in for ashes and ashes to go, no Bible study on Ash Wednesday.
What was
so
that date?
The 26th of February. So really we're only meeting
only
once in February. We're only meeting the 12th of February. Okay. I'm sorry about that, but that's just the way the calendar works.
Oh, sure.
And then in March we pick up Lent and we'll meet all of Lent.
Okay, good.
All right. Mm-hmm. So, but February is really just the one day. I need to ask the school strategic planning meeting if we could meet on Tuesday, because they always seem to do it on Wednesday. But that seems to be better for other people.
So only February.
Only February 12th.
Oh, 12th.
Is
okay,
the Bible study meeting, and I'll remind you of that next week when we meet too.
Good morning.
So. You know, it is what it is. And I can't believe Lent is starting.
Oh, no.
No, I can't either.
Well, it's actually not. It's Easter is relatively late this year. Oh. But
it just snuck up in a hurry.
I always have this fantasy that between Christmas and Lent, I'm going to get stuff done.
Yes, that's
and
my
thing. And it just never really happens that way. It's like the summer. I have all this list of stuff I want to get done during the summer. And
I think for one thing, especially the older you get, the holidays take more out of you, even if you're not doing much. And so you're so exhausted when January comes, for whatever reason you are, and January just disappears.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
winter can disappear as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I
wish you would. Yes.
I said that to Liz yesterday. I'm like, okay, I've seen the snow. It can go away now. But, you know.
I miss it. I always look forward to winter.
Send you a picture.
Well, you can have it.
Everybody tells me that.
Well, and before we dig into to Acts again, I just want to give you, to say to you all that you all who have come to this Bible study and know a little bit more about Paul, you will have had a sneak preview into the sermon. Because my sermon is about Paul the troublemaker. Because we're celebrating the conversion of St. Paul on Sunday. So everybody else will get to hear about Paul the troublemaker. So.
Oh, time for a nap.
You can't take a nap.
No, you really can't.
Definitely you. Of all people.
Well, so let's pick up in chapter 17. And in case you've forgotten where we've picked up Paul, he's on his second journey, which is the bright yellow on the map. And Marilyn, do you want one of these? I have four. No, you got one. Okay. He's on the kind of bright yellow one. And we're about to pick him up in Thessalonica, which is in Greece, in the right up here.
Oh, right.
Near the Acropolis, in kind of that flat part of Greece. If you go across from the straits.
Yeah, the top of the bay.
Yes. That's where we're going to pick him up. And Thessalonica is a town you may have heard of, if only because there are two letters to the Thessalonians in Scripture, and that's who those are written to, the church in Thessalonica or the Thessalonians. You can see by its location, this is a port city, and it is a... It is a reasonably cosmopolitan port because if you're in Italy and want to get to Asia, to Turkey, one of it's not marked on here because it's not the way Paul went, but one of the things people did was come down Italy, sail across this little short part of the Adriatic Sea, go across the kind of isthmus of Greece there, and then you can sail a relatively short way from Thessalonica around to... So it's a pretty cosmopolitan port. Lots of people end up there. And so we're about to hear about Paul in Thessalonica. And more about Paul the troublemaker. So we're going to pick up at the first verse of chapter 17. And the first chunk is through verse 15. After Paul and Silas had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days argued with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This is the Messiah, Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you." Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. But the Jews became jealous, and with the help of some ruffians in the marketplaces, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. While they were searching for Paul and Silas to bring them out of the assembly, they attacked Jason's house. When they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some believers before the city authorities, shouting, "These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has entertained them as guests. They are all acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor, saying that there is another king named Jesus." The people and the city officials were disturbed when they heard this, and after they had taken bail from Jason and the others, they let them go. That very night, the believers sent Paul and Silas off to Beroea, and when they arrived, they went to the Jewish synagogue. These Jews were more receptive than those in Thessalonica, for they welcomed the message very eagerly and examined the Scriptures every day to see whether these things were so. Many of them therefore believed, including not a few Greek women and men of high standing. But when the Jews of Thessalonica learned that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul in Beroea as well, they came there too to stir up and incite the crowds. Then the believers immediately sent Paul away to the coast, but Silas and Timothy remained behind. Those who conducted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and after receiving instructions to have Silas and Timothy join him as soon as possible, they left him. So I love that phrase, "These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here too." But as you see, Paul does his thing. He lands in the city. Notice that he goes to the synagogue three Sabbaths in a row, so 3 weeks, preaching, and notice who he gets. Some of the Jews, a great many of devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. And then this is the same thing that happens when he gets to Beroea. Some people from the synagogue, but also some of the leading women and men.
It's interesting that they use the adjective leading with mm-hmm. women, because mm-hmm. in that society, you wouldn't think of women leading at all.
Synonym for wealthy, probably.
Yes.
Yes.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's a synonym for wealthy. And so Paul is repeating his pattern, right? He gets in a place, he starts at the synagogue, but gathers a whole bunch of people from kind of a whole bunch of different bits of society, and it causes trouble. And they kick him out, or convince him to move on.
The thing that bothers me most about this story is that I have a very strong feeling that if I were living there at that time, mm-hmm. I would not believe it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that?
It's just, I don't know, my cynical or skeptical nature, but I just would own another one of those.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's probably true. I mean, I think
and
most...
And it's something new. It's a change.
And it is contrary to what you have been taught to believe your whole life. Whether you are a devout Jew, when it says the devout Greeks, what that means is people who were not born and raised Jewish, but who are exploring and have come to faith in the God of Israel. Or if you're a Greek person who has believed in the Greek deities. In any case, what Paul is teaching is not what you were raised to believe. So if you
something
are not...
totally new.
And it is challenging to the world view of these people. Remember, we talk about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or the God of Israel. We talk about the Greek gods. We talk about the Roman gods, right? All of these things, the gods are the gods of a people. So to leave your people's gods is, in this worldview, it's not the same as, well, I was raised Catholic and I'm going to go now be Lutheran in the United States, where, you know, that's maybe not such a big deal. To actually leave your tribe's gods is to leave the tribe. So...
it's like Christ and culture.
Part of the reason the Roman Empire is so successful in conquering and ruling conquered people is that they are a polytheistic religion. So it's very easy for them to incorporate other people's gods into their pantheon, right? So, oh, you have a god. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, it could be, you know, that your god is just like this god of ours. You can call him that. That's fine.
They have two names. This is the Roman name. This is the
Greek
name.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was how we learned it.
Right.
Yes.
And, but for Jesus, and we've talked before about it's part of the reason that the Jews have such a problem with the Roman Empire, because they are monotheistic. And by the time of Jesus, by the time of the Roman conquest, exclusively monotheistic. They weren't exclusively monotheistic at the beginning, right? We've talked about that in the Ten Commandments, that the Ten Commandment even says, I am the Lord your God, you will have no other gods before me. Not that you won't have any other gods at the time of the Ten Commandments, but none before me.
What other gods did they have?
Oh, everybody had gods at the time of the Ten Commandments. I mean, remember the story of Jacob. When he goes to get wives, he gets Leah and Rachel. And when they leave Rachel's home, she takes her father's personal gods and puts them in her saddlebags and steals them. Right? So even Rachel, who is the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, you know, founders of the tribe, some of the 12 tribes of Israel, has gods other than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Covering her base.
Yeah.
Yes.
So she takes her father's gods so that she's sure she has them with her. Right? Now that's 5,000 years before what we're talking about here. By the time of about 100 years before Jesus, when the Roman Empire conquers Israel, the faith of Israel has become exclusively monotheistic. So they only have the one God and will only worship the one God. So it's harder for them to incorporate into the...
And they also have a God of no name.
Right.
Where the Romans and the Greeks name their gods and display that.
Right. The other thing that we forget when we read this is that at this time, the Roman emperors are called the Son of God and are worshipped as the Son of God. So for Jesus to be claimed as the Son of God is to put him on a parallel with the emperor. This is a problem. Right? Because the emperor's not all that keen on having an equal. certainly not keen on having somebody who is a superior to him. And so,
a peasant from all appearances.
Exactly. So when
straight.
When the authorities of Thessalonica say they're claiming there's another king, this is a big deal because they don't want the Roman army cracking down on them. They like their life, and they're a busy trading port. It would be easy for Rome to really mess up their life, right? All they'd have to do is close the port. And so, and also, when I said it's a cosmopolitan city, like all port cities kind of throughout time, it does mean that things are maybe just barely held in check, right? That's kind of the way ports work. The law is
hovering.
And kind of turning a blind eye to some things that, for the sake of peace in the city, that if there's a crackdown, is going to be a problem, right? So it's important to understand the reaction of people to Paul. He's a bull in a china shop. He doesn't do any of this subtly. He just comes in and says, Jesus is the Messiah, let me prove it to you. And off he goes. So this is not the first time that Paul's been kicked out of town.
It's interesting the contrast between Jesus and Paul mm-hmm. in terms of personality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Jesus was spreading his word and the way Paul went about it.
Yes, Paul is not the let's build relationships and talk in parables and let me tell you a story to illustrate the ways of God type person. Paul is a...
Love one another.
Yeah. Paul is a let me show you why you're wrong type of person.
In your face.
In your face. That's a very good way to put it. So once again, Paul is encouraged to leave town, and he ends up in Athens to wait for Silas and Timothy to join him. Athens is the capital of Greece then as now, and it's a bigger city than Thessalonica. It also has a port, but trade is less its primary commerce and then government and education. Right. So Athens is still, at this point in the Roman Empire, viewed as the center of culture. If you want to go to the most cultured city in the world, you would go to Athens.
It's much more open to the rest of the world than Thessaloniki, which is yes. hidden away in the
Yes. And it's an older city than Rome. And rather looks down its nose on other cities. It's kind of like Paris in the 1920s, that, you know, everything is Paris and everything else is just a pale impersonation of Paris. Athens has that kind of sense about it at this time. So... let's find out what trouble Paul gets into in Athens. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. Some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign divinities." This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took him and brought him to the Areopagus and asked him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? It sounds rather strange to us, so we would like to know what it means." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, "To an unknown God." What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, he who is Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things. From one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live, so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for him and find him, though indeed he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we too are his offspring. Since we are God's offspring, we ought not think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of mortals. While God has overlooked the times of human ignorance, now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he would have the world judged in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some scoffed, but others said, "We will hear you again about this." At that point, Paul left them, but some of them joined him and became believers, including Dionysus the Areopagite and a woman named Demarius, and others with them. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Athens. Athens is the center of education and philosophy. And you see that Luke thinks that this is a waste of time. He says it here where Paul is we said, let's see. Now all the at verse 21, now all the Athenians and foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. This is Luke's way of saying, oh, they spend their time arguing philosophy. What's that about?
Oh, I thought it was going to be something positive because they were open to something new.
Yes, we would think it that way. Luke says they just spend their time arguing about this stuff.
Okay.
Why don't they do something important? Remember that the Luke who is writing Acts thinks the most important thing in the world is justice for the poor. So he would see this arguing about philosophy as a waste of time and energy that could be spent in
helping the poor,
doing something to make the world a better place. Why are you arguing philosophy? And I don't know if you noticed, but in verse 18 it says also some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you studied philosophy in college, you might remember this. This is kind of the high period of Greek philosophy. The Epicureans, that word has come into our vocabulary with a connotation about basically foodies. But
that's what I was thinking. I was trying to figure out how that fit.
the Epicureans and the Stoics were two different ends of the spectrum of philosophy. The Epicureans believe that God has given everything for our joy, and so you should try as much as you possibly can to experience the joys of the world. And in that way, you are pleasing God by exploring everything that he has to offer. In our world, this has come to be about food, because one of the ways that the Epicureans tried everything was eating a whole bunch of stuff.
Eat, drink, and be merry.
I don't know that it's true, but there's a legend that the Epicureans are the ones who brought us lobster and artichokes, because they were the ones who said, well, maybe there's something good to eat in here. Which, you know, if you look at a lobster, you know, somebody who looks at a lobster and says, we should eat this, is, you know, there's something in here worth fighting for. And the same thing with an artichoke, right? You know, there's something in here worth fighting for, really?
And how do you get to it?
So again, I don't know that that's true, but it's that sense of, you know, well, we're going to try everything.
And is that like hedonism?
It's kind of related to hedonism, but not quite, because hedonism is the pursuit of pleasure for pleasure's own sake. Mm-hmm. Epicureans were, at least certainly at the point of where Paul is encountering them, is exploration in the pursuit of joy for the way that joy reveals God's presence. So it's a little bit of a distinction.
Yes, yes.
The Stoics, on the other hand, are ascetics. So they believe that God is most found in self-denial. So, and Stoicism, the connotation in our current vocabulary, explains about the philosophy, right? If I say, well, he's a Stoic, that means they patiently put up with trials and tribulations. And that's the sense of the Stoic philosophy, is that whatever comes to you, you should accept and embrace as the presence of God, to seek to find what it is God wants you to learn from it.
It certainly sounds like an easy choice if you're picking.
Yes.
I'll be here.
There's got to be middle ground.
You see, you were meant to be an Anglican, always looking for the middle ground. But Athens is a hotbed of different philosophies, and as you see from the story, from different religions, right? And the Areopagus, which I will learn to say one of these days, is the place where they go to argue.
Oh, okay, that
all
was
right?
my question.
That's where they go to argue. So when they say they took him to the Areopagus, you have to be invited into the Areopagus. And
so it's where they go to
debate.
More than
right.
argue.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
It probably
yes.
ends up arguing, but
right. it's
civil.
Right. The Areopagus in Athens at this point is what the vision of what all universities want to be, the place where all the different philosophies come together and discuss and debate, and all ideas have their airings, right? That's really what the Areopagus was, but they were picky. You couldn't just show, this wasn't Hyde Park Corner in London where anybody could get up on a box and say what they wanted. You had to be invited in. So when they pick up Paul and take him to the Areopagus, what they're saying is, you're educated enough to join in our debate. All right? So Paul has kind of found his... This is Paul's jam. you know, Paul has found his people.
not sort of off.
Yes.
Off, but what encouraged people to join Paul? Curiosity? Did they get a vision?
A couple of things. First, curiosity, certainly. And also, Paul must have been a good arguer, because he gets, I mean, we hear it here, he gets Dionysus the Areopagite, that is a member, a leader of the Areopagus, to join him. So he must have been good at arguing. But also, the message that Paul is preaching, and we'll hear more about his message when we get into his letters, but the idea that everyone is welcome equally in the household of God is particularly appealing, because that's not the message of anybody else's gods. Everybody else's gods say there's a hierarchy, and if you're not
up there,
you're down there, and that's where God wants you to be. This is not a world where there are self-made men, right? You're born into the state you're born into, and that's how that goes.
And he was wealthy and educated and all those things that would appeal to people as well.
Right. So Paul saying, as a member of the, maybe not quite the upper class, because he is a Jew, but he's well-educated and well enough off that he can travel, which is not a common thing. And he's a little bit exotic, because he's come from these places that most of these people have only heard of. right?
And confident that he's always right.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so all of that together makes him rather attractive, and people are at least willing to listen to him. And then, of course, you know, the message he's proclaiming is God loves you, and you are acceptable to God the way that you are. That is a message that nobody else is proclaiming. And if you pay attention to who, as we go through this, who this really resonates with, it resonates with slaves and poor people, which makes sense. A message that there is no slave or free, there is no, you know, Jew or Greek, there is no, that all are equal in the sight of God, is a really strong message. And leading women, right? The wealthy women who find their lives constrained by a hierarchical, patriarchal society, this message of there is neither male nor female, Jew or Greek, really resonates with them. And as we read the letters, we'll see that that causes some trouble. But also Paul's message that all you have to do is believe. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to change. You don't have to offer sacrifices. You don't have to, make big fancy gestures. Just believe, and that's enough. Is also radically different from the rest of the faiths around him. So that it's open to everyone, that the entry level is low, that faith is enough, and that all are welcome on an equal basis. Those three things together.
Why doesn't that seem like a low entry point to us?
Yeah, I question that too, because faith is a biggie.
Yes,
I mean, where your heart and mind and soul, you know, that's a biggie. I mean, that's your whole being practically, like, and governs how you live and everything.
But again, remember, in this world, there is no such thing as people who don't believe in any God. I mean, there really is no such thing as an atheist in the ancient world. That there are gods is as accepted as a given, you know. The sun's going to come up in the morning and there are gods. These are things that we don't argue about. And that there are sea monsters if you sail off the edge of the world. But, you know.
And you could sail off the edge of the world.
And that the gods are active in our world is an accepted part of the worldview. You know, we hear about this in the Gospels and in the, you know, we're always looking for reasons that things happen. Well, in a world before germ theory and, you know, all of these things, lots of things happen because God wanted them to.
There's no other explanation than
right.
God.
Not at that time.
Right. So having faith in a God was not a big leap. So changing the God you have faith in is potentially a big leap, but if you're not satisfied with the God you're believing in, this God sounds a lot better. Mm-hmm. And remember that these are conquered people who have already adapted their faith to believe in, you know, to incorporate at least practices that were acceptable to the conquerors, right? And also, notice that Paul tends to be in cosmopolitan places, right? He's not preaching in rural Greece. He's preaching in the place where already lots of different ideas come together. So among people who have already heard about lots of different faiths. So this isn't the first new idea that they've heard, particularly in Athens, but really in any place. Notice where Paul goes, right? He goes to Thessalonica. We're going to hear him in Corinth. He goes to Athens. He goes to Ephesus. mostly he goes to places that are already cosmopolitan cities.
This unknown, there was an altar to the unknown God.
An unknown God.
Now, Paul comes in with all of his message about our spiritual God. Mm-hmm. What did they think this unknown God was that they were already had an altar to and were worshiping in some manner?
They probably didn't know. Mm-hmm. Athens, remember, is the center of all the ideas. Right? So we're going to throw up altars to all the gods. And notice this is where this starts, right? Paul is deeply distressed that the city was full of idols. Mm-hmm. That's because Athens throws up an altar to everybody's god. Oh, you're living here now. Yeah. Look, there's a space. We can build an altar to your god. And oh, okay, well, and what do you worship? Oh, okay, well, we'll build an altar to your god over here. So it makes sense that in a place like that, well, there may be gods we don't know about, so we better have an altar for them too. So they throw up an altar to the god we don't know about yet. And notice what Paul does. Paul is very clever. He doesn't tell them that they're wrong.
But he says that you ignorantly worship him.
You ignorantly worship him. Ignorant not being the insult we think it is in academic debate. Ignorant meaning unknowingly, right? You're worshiping this, you've put up this altar to the unknown God, and you're worshiping him not knowing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you about that God that you've been worshiping.
Do it better.
Yeah. Let me tell you about that God that you've been worshiping not knowing about. And of course, he's in the Areopagus. So they're like, oh, we'd like to learn about that. Because that's what we do. And then we're going to argue with you once we've heard you out. But
so can you talk about verse 26? This is how he's explaining.
From one ancestor, he made... I will say that there's a translation issue there. Uh-huh. It could mean one ancestor. It also could mean one blood. So from one peoples, rather than one... One ancestor carries a connotation of a single individual. The one blood, which is an alternate translation of that, carries more of a connotation of from one peoples rather than one person, if that makes sense. He made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live. So what Paul is claiming is that the God of Israel is the God who created heavens and earth. Now, every faith has a creation story, right? Mm-hmm. But he's claiming our God is the one who really did it. So, notice he doesn't give evidence, he's just making the claim. And that certainly would be the first part of an argument, is you've got all these gods, and that's great, but our God is actually the God who created the heavens and the earth. And you can tell that's true because our God doesn't need human beings to serve him. All these other gods have temples that you have to maintain, you have to bring stuff to, you have to take care of your God, in other words. And what he's saying is, I can prove that our God is the God that created everything because he doesn't need that.
Some Protestant churches, I grew up for a while in Baptist church, mm-hmm. They don't want to have any depictions mm-hmm. of Jesus. Mm-hmm. They don't even like to have a cross mm-hmm. because it's a, like this says.
It's a symbol made with hands, and God doesn't need that.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So that's,
From the very beginning, he demanded a portion of the produce and all
yes.
that
stuff. Yes, but by the time... Remember, Paul's talking about Jesus now. So Paul's talking about Jesus, and what he's saying is, going forward, if you believe in our God, you don't have to bring stuff to a temple.
Your firstborn.
Right. You don't have to bring an offering to the temple to our God. Our God is big enough to be beyond living in anything you can create.
It's not It's not the Hebrew God, then.
Well, it is the God of the Hebrews, but in the way that we worship it, we worship him in Jesus.
Okay, that's a little confusing.
It is a little confusing. Yeah. But there are Jewish people in Athens, because Paul goes first to the synagogue. But notice, the people in Athens, the Jews in Athens, probably none of them go to the temple in Jerusalem. Athens to Jerusalem is a long way. So the Jews in Athens will have evolved their faith to not making sacrifices, because the place you make sacrifices is the temple in Jerusalem. They're not going to Jerusalem. So there are Jewish people living in Athens who never make sacrifices to their God, because they never go to the place to make sacrifices. So it's not that big a stretch for Paul to say, no. See, you don't have to bring it. God doesn't need anything you have to bring.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Because you don't make sacrifices in a synagogue. You only make sacrifices in a temple. And the only temple for Jews is in Jerusalem. So really, any of these places Paul goes that are any further, well, certainly than Tarshish, the faith of the Jews in those places no longer depends on offering sacrifice to God, because they never go where you offer sacrifices.
Would he have used the teaching of, in as much as you have done to the least of these?
You've done it to me? Not quite sure. Probably, certainly Luke knows that teaching, and at least at this point, Luke is traveling with Paul. So, probably, but we don't have a lot of evidence of that. So Paul, this is really, the world is really perfectly, kind of pretty set up for Paul. He's finding people who believe in the God of Israel, but who have evolved their faith and practice away from being a religion of sacrifices, because there isn't a temple where they are. So they are becoming more and more a religion of, I don't want to say faith rather than practice, because that's not quite right, but a religion that doesn't rely on having a temple to be the center of the worship. So that's yet another reason that Paul's message resonates. Because I would imagine at least some of the Jews in some of these places are feeling a little bit guilty that they haven't made the trip to Jerusalem to offer the sacrifices that the law of Moses demands. And here comes Paul saying, the law has been completed in Jesus. Jesus has made a sacrifice once for all, and we're going to hear about that in his letters. You no longer have to go to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices. Jesus has done it for you. Oh, whew. Good, I don't have to, you know, particularly when we get to Malta, which is... But certainly Athens, the idea that anyone in Athens would go to Jerusalem is just ridiculous. You wouldn't do that. Why would you do that?
Even the richest people.
Well, if you're the richest people in Athens, there's no reason for you to go to Jerusalem. There's, you know. But
a kind of a rural outpost.
Yeah. So, and even for the richest people, it's not easy to get there. If you want to go from Athens to Jerusalem...
You have to go by water.
You would have to go by water, which is a big deal. I mean, this is a day before lifeboats, right? And steel-hulled ships. So it's pretty big deal. You would sail probably actually from Athens, you would go to Corinth and sail around the isthmus rather than sail, because there's some islands kind of in the way. So you would travel first to Corinth and then go around the islands to Ephesus. And then remember, you can't lose sight of the coast. So you would kind of hopscotch the coast. And from, I know it looks like Paul goes directly there, but he actually would have probably hit a couple of these ports along the way and would land it in Caesarea and then go overland to Jerusalem. This is a dangerous long journey. Even by sea, it's even mostly by sea, it's 500, 600 miles. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. It's not like you're getting in your car. I mean, 600 miles by car is still a big deal for us, right? I mean, that's still a 8 to 10 hour drive, depending on how fast you drive. But for them, that's a journey that you, in all likelihood, wouldn't come back from. So the idea that you would leave Athens and go to Jerusalem and never come back, probably not so much.
Didn't Paul have a school of people that
yes.
followed him? Did
yes.
they also travel like he did?
Well, certainly some of them do. We know that Luke was with him part of the journey. We've heard about Silas and Timothy and Barnabas traveling with him some of the time. So they
did the same thing?
Yeah. Although nobody is with him all the time. So it's more like Luke joins him here and drops off when he gets here, and Silas and Timothy are with him in Thessalonica, and they join him in Athens, but some of them don't go the rest of the way with him. So it's kind of an ever-changing group. And some people who come to believe in one city may follow him to the next city, and then when he moves on from there, go back.
And become the leader and the teacher
in that city.
Yeah.
So
he's the church.
Yeah. So he's always got a group with him, but it's not always the same people. There are a few whose names we know who are with him a lot, and some that we don't know. So I think that's probably a good place to stop because we're at the end of chapter 17. So next week we will pick up chapter 18.
I have one more question.
Sure.
It's interesting that he mentions, and even some of your poets have said, mm-hmm. for we too are his offspring. Mm-hmm. This is the classical Greek poets?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
What verse is that in?
It's 28.
Verse 28. And I'm looking for the quote. Mm-hmm. The first quotation, I'll read my note. The first quotation, which is the, for in him we live and move and have our being. Uh-huh. The first quotation is sometimes attributed to Epimenides. The second is from the opening lines of the Phenomena by Aratus, a Greek poet of Sicilia. He was a Stoic. So the first quote, in him we live and move and have our being, is also from a Greek poet. The for we too are his offspring, we can identify as belonging to a writing by the Stoic philosopher. Phenomena, which is, if you've studied philosophy, that's a major work of Stoic philosophy. So he's using their own Greek poet quotes. In the same way, when he's talking to Jews, he quotes...
Good approach.
He quotes the Hebrew scripture. Mm-hmm. Here he's talking to Greeks. He quotes Greek poets and philosophers. Yeah. So... But that in whom we live and move and have our being, that's really been taken into Christian philosophy. And actually, one of the things that happens relatively early in the Christian world is that the Neoplatonists, who are the leading philosophers, a lot of them become Christians, and a lot of Christians take on the philosophy of Plato and the Neoplatonists. So... we get a lot of Platonic philosophy working its way into Christian theology.
Wow, that's so interesting.
So,
in fact,
so interesting.
That recognition and belief in spiritualism mm-hmm. started with Socrates, I think.
Mm-hmm. And,
and Plato learned it from
Socrates. Yes, the idea that the spirit and the body are separate mm-hmm. and separable is Platonic philosophy. That's not Jewish theology. The Jews would say the spirit is an integral part of the body. Indeed, the idea that the life of the animal lives in its blood, that the life of the person lives in its blood, that the two are not divisible, is Hebrew philosophy. The idea that there is body and spirit and that they're separate is Platonic. Socrates to Plato, to the Neoplatonists, to Augustine, and into Christian theology. So, when I was learning in seminary, one of the first things my theology professor taught us is scratch a Christian, find a Neoplatonist, because that Neoplatonic philosophy is so now deeply ingrained with the evolution of Christian theology that it's hard to separate the two. It wasn't there originally, but it comes in very quickly. Certainly Jesus doesn't appear to have that kind of idea. Jesus is much more tied to Old Testament Hebrew theology. By the time we get to Paul, we get the Platonic coming in. Paul certainly would have been educated in Plato. And you can begin to see the two fusing. And it's a part of the reason that Paul is a very good missionary, because he does exactly what the Romans do in a slightly different way. He takes what he finds everywhere he goes and figures out how to bring it into the faith that he's teaching. So,
and he's educated well enough, evidently, to know the poetry and et cetera.
And be able to do that. To take what people already believe to be true, what all people already know, and bring it into.
So where was he when he learned all this?
In Tarshish. He would have been educated in Tarshish in what is called rhetoric, but is really what they called rhetoric in those days is really philosophy. And that was, if you were an educated person, the way you were marked as an educated person is the ability to make public argument. That's, like today, if you want to be an educated person, you have to pass exams. In those days, if you wanted to be an educated person, you had to be able to stand up and argue philosophy in public.
And defend your
position. So that's what it meant to be educated.
Ideally, yes.
I mean, that's where
really.
Our concept.
That was the ideal.
Yeah, that's where our concept of Senate rules come from. It's why it takes 60 senators to close debate, because the philosophy behind the Senate is that the most educated people should be able to argue as long as it takes them to come to consensus. So you shouldn't, in the House, which was the more plebeian House, the more slightly less educated people.
The rest of us, they
should be able to close debate faster because they're just going to go around in circles. But the senators,
and that all comes from Athens.
It all comes from Athens.
The whole idea of a
that's
Senate
right.
and a senator.
Yep.
And the plebeians.
That's right. Yep. Our entire structure of government comes from ancient Athens. And the ideals of what a philosopher ruler should be. So, it's also the reason the Senate has longer terms than the House. That the idea being that the arguments in the Senate may take more time, and they should not be as influenced by the clamoring of the public. So, the senators should be more removed from that and should have more time to really consider their arguments without having to worry about standing for election and convincing the public all the time. Whereas the House has to stand for election very frequently. So they are much more movable by the will of the people, is the idea anyway. And that's also why the money bills all have to start in the House. Anything about money has to start in the people's house, the one that's more influenced by the people. Because if you're going to spend their money, you should have to answer to them.
I like the ideas.
Right.
You wrote in yesterday's paper, you know, that reflection is quoting somebody every day.
Yes.
Gandhi saying, I like Christianity, I just don't like Christians.
Christians. The quote is great. He says, I like your Christ, I just don't like you. Right. Your Christians. Your Christians are very much not like your Christ.
Right.
So.
You know, with all our respect for rhetoric and the ability to convey your ideas and construct good paragraphs of thought and so forth and debate, as our children
see you next week, Art.
Progress in their texting, they're going to fail totally at that ability.
That ability is already gone.
Yeah. Well, and that's a shame.
Well, the question then is the world changing? I mean, the idea that being able to stand up and construct an oral argument that refers to other thinkers, that wasn't always the way you judged an educated person. Right. It became the way you judged an educated person with the rise of Athenian, basically with the rise of Athens. But before that, an educated person was one who could interpret nature, who knew what plants did what, who could figure out when to plant and when to harvest, and what healed and what plants you should plant together.
I wasn't claiming that was a good measure of an educated person. I was simply saying that in and of itself, it's a very respected and valuable capability to have to express your ideas and speak well, and write well. I just think that's a very valuable skill. It's not the only skill a good educated person has to have.
It also helps you to organize your thoughts.
Sure. Sure. And I mean, I have a liberal arts education, and I really value it. But I do see that these days,
it's not happening.
These days, it's more effective to be able to communicate one idea simply than connected ideas. You know, so in a lot of ways, be able to take a complex idea and communicate it in 140 characters is maybe more valuable than being able to do what I do here, which is pull in all the. I mean, I enjoy this, and I think you all do too. But
But when you get deeper into things, you've got to be able to draw in the connections.
Right. Yes.
You know, for people who really want to get serious about these topics.
Yes. And
I agree with you that when it isn't there or available
to you from the person that's discussing, it seems very shallow without having.
And really to get more.
And just like rabbis, the real reason you pay me isn't to manage this little business that is St. Paul's. The real reason you pay me is so that I have time to educate myself so that I can
educate.
Priest's office used to be called studies, with the idea that the priest was supposed to be there studying.
Which is very much like the Jewish
the idea of a rabbi.
Yes.
Teacher.
And
teacher.
So
yeah.
everybody does everything to make it possible for that person to study. Quiet space, finances, everything, so he doesn't have to work, sort of thing.
And therefore, that person's answer is the correct answer, too.
Right, because they've done the work research and, So it's, it's not that far removed from...
No, it isn't.
No.
Interesting.
Which is always interesting when you can take stuff back and back. Yeah. And like the Senate to the Senate. From Washington to Athens. That's a leap.
That's interesting. in Buddhism, the monks don't prepare food or do any kind of work.
Right.
People bring them food, and they don't need money.
Because they're supposed to pray and study on behalf of people.
What I thought the really family said, because I said so, it wasn't necessarily a statement that was just pompous or whatever. Or it was flip. Because yeah. he was the head of the family and therefore knew more and he was correct.
All right. So more.